It's my pleasure to introduce to you Rabbi Seth Farber, who's the founder and director of E-Team, which is an organization in Israel doing very important work helping individuals navigate the conversion process and other issues in Israel. Rabbi Farber is a graduate of Yeshiva University, where he received his smicha, and he is going to speak to you this morning about new halachot emerging from Israel's rabbinic courts.
Good morning. It's again an honor to be here and have the opportunity to address you and study with you a little. My topic has become more relevant in the last 2 hours. I was woken up this morning at 5:45 by my office in Jerusalem. To some extent, this relates to last night's discussion, but it also relates to my topic this morning. In the last hour and a half, the chief rabbinate has submitted their response to our Supreme Court brief related to conversions performed in Israel. And their response, which I'm sure you'll be reading about in the coming hours on the internet, or hopefully you'll be here all day with me, and then you won't be reading about it unless you have one of these little things, because I'm getting updates by the hour. But their response itself, which I'll share with you in a second, also represents a new type of halakha that's emerging. The reason I say it's a new halakha that's emerging is that in Medinat Israel today, we're facing a fundamental problem that's yashan v'gam chadash. It's an old problem. It's an endemic problem to our people in one sense. And it's also a new phenomenon in the sense that right now, given the legal constellation of Israel, we have an enormous body politic that is essentially having many, many personal status issues governed by an orthodox body that not only doesn't understand the world of the rank and file, but isn't connected to it in any meaningful way. So when orthodox rabbis or rabbinical courts come to address issues of personal status because the law gives them the power, empowers them to do so, there's a fundamental challenge that's part and parcel. So this morning when the Israeli chief rabbinate looked out at 4,500 converts whom they had converted and taken responsibility for and basically said, if you want to get married, so you have to go to specific marriage registrars, and not to the local marriage registrar who all the other Jews go to. And that's the thrust of what they answered this morning in the Supreme Court. I know, you're thinking to me, what am I doing here? And I should be there, right? So, okay, things happen. I mentioned to someone over Shabbos that, when we filed the brief, so they gave us the state gave this Rabbanut 60 days to respond. Those 60 days, according to my count, finished last week. So I called our lawyer on Monday and I said, knew what happened. So he called the Machleket Bagatzim, the Supreme Court, and he said, what happened? Where's your answer? This is what I love about Israel. They said, Sukkot doesn't count in the 60 days. It's also a new halacha. Either way, what's important for me is to note that, and it is important for me to note that not everything, in other words, the fundamental challenge, which I'm going to describe this morning in a number of prisms, it's not all bad. In fact, there's two I would even say diametrically opposed approaches towards the new reality of the last 60 years and the fact that Orthodox rabbis or ultra-Orthodox rabbis are empowered to determine personal status issues for a non-Orthodox body politic. There are some that are very open to this, understand what's at stake in my mind, and I'll describe that in a few minutes, and there are others who less understand that. I want to begin, though, with a biblical text. The biblical text is very close to my heart. It's actually in the liturgy. It's the first source on the first page in the text in front of you. It's a text from the prophet Isaiah, Yeshayahu. It's in the liturgy as the haftarah for the Taniyot Tzibur. Standing on the precipice of what he perceived to be a redemptive moment in Jewish history, the prophet Isaiah looks out at the community in front of him, and he calls for a national revival, or nothing less than that, based on justice and righteousness. Ko amar Hashem shimru mishpat v'asu tzedaka ki krova yeshuati lavo v'tzidkati lehigalot. This is the opportunity we have to fundamentally buy into justice and righteousness for now and forever. For this is the redemptive moment. Ashrei enosh yaaseh zot uben adam yachazik ba shomer shabbat mechalalo v'shamor yado me'asot kol ra. Right, the person blessed is the person who essentially buys into the covenant. Shabbat was one of the markers of buying into the covenant. And then the prophet looks out, and he identifies or singles out two individuals. Two individuals who I'm going to talk about this morning, in fact. I assume this text is more familiar to some of you than others, but let me just read it inside. Pasuk Gimel. Ve'al yomar ben hanechar hanilval Adonai lemor, havdel yavdileni Adonai mi'alamo, ve'al yomar hasaris hen ani etyavesh. Let not the ben nechar hanilval Hashem. That's a phrase you know from later biblical books, right? Nilvim el Hashem, or kol hanilvim elav. The ben hanechar, the non-Jew, the alien, who is nilva, who walks with God. Who's that in one word? That's a convert. Right? You remember from Megillat Esther. Kol hanilvim alehem al yavur. Let him not say, havdel yavdileni Hashem mi'alamo. God has separated me out from his people. Va'al yomar hasaris. The Saris, we generally translate it as officer. Of course, that comes from later Hebrew, right? Saris was in the Torah. Saris is the eunuch, the person who's castrated, the man who can't bring children into the world, right? Later, it became the officers because they used to castrate the officers in the court. Let not the Saris say Hein ani etziavesh. Now, these two people couldn't have, in first glance, less to do with each other, right? The ger and the Saris, they seem to have nothing to do with each other. And then the prophet continues to speak to each of them. Kicho, first he speaks to the second one. First, Kicho Amar Hashem Lasarisim, Asher Yishmeru Et Shabtotayu, V'achoru B'asher Chafatzi, U'machazikim B'Vriti. Right, the Saris, the eunuch, the castrated man, the man who can't bring children into the world, who buys into the covenant. God speaks to him and says, V'natati Lahem B'Veiti U'vachol Motai. This is where it comes from. Yad Vashem, for an everlasting world, Tov Mibanim U'Bano. It's a phrase that comes from Shmuel. Right, that's what Eli said to Chana. Right, I'll give you something. Am I not better than you than Banim Ubanot? It's a phrase that's, on the judgmental side, it's very difficult to say that. For people like counsel, people sometimes who can't have kids, very difficult to say, I'll give you something better than kids. But either way, that's what the prophet says. Shem Olam, an everlasting name, Eten Lo Asher Lo Yikaret. And what about the second group? B'nei HaNechar Nilvim Al HaShem LaSharato, LaVad Shem HaShem Liot Lo LaVadim, Kol Shomer Shabbat Mechalalo, U'machazikim B'Vriti. What about the second person, the convert? Verse we're very familiar with, right? They'll also be part of the covenant. Okay, look at me for a minute and just tell me. What are these two people? Thank you very much. I appreciate it. What do these two people have in common? The Saris and the Ben HaNechar Nilval Hashem. What do they have in common? Why does the prophet feel the need to single them out? Yeah. Good. Both of these people feel exceptionally alienated. At the precipice of redemptive era, these two people stand the greatest risk of feeling alienated, of feeling disenfranchised, of feeling outside the community. And thus the prophet feels the absolute need, right, to make sure they feel included, they feel part of things. Because it's so easy for each of these individuals to feel outside. Okay? Which just begs the question, so why two? Just say, those who feel outside, come inside. Right, you can be part of this also. You are no less a part of the people than the people who are, you know, living on the periphery is no less than being on the inside. But the prophet chooses these two specific people. And now let me ask the other question. What's the difference between them? What's the difference between the ger, the Ben HaNechar, Nilval HaShem, and the Saris?
The ger can change his
status,
the Saris cannot.
Okay, the Saris has a very difficult time changing his status. Right, in other words, he's living in a very, very difficult present, whereas the ger already has changed his status to a large extent. It's even more than that, though. Think about why each one of the both of them have essentially lost hope. Right? They both have lost. What's the difference? What's the basis of their losing hope? Yeah. Okay. The ger has made a choice. The saris is not clear whether he's made a choice or not. I don't want to get into the halachic definition of it, but maybe we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But there's something even more fundamental about them. Anybody else? The ger can have children in the Saris, which means essentially from a conceptual perspective, yeah? Okay, now you've used the critical word. What does the Ger lose hope for? The Ger doesn't have a shared past with the Jewish people, and therefore he feels alienated. The Tsaritz has that shared past, but he doesn't have a shared future. Right? You can lose hope because you don't feel like you have something, right? No, think about it. In terms of a Ger, right, I once was a Dayan on a Beit Din for conversion. I remember in this case, it was a woman who converted, and she came out of the mikvah. She came into the room with the Dayanim. We all said Mazal Tov. Right? I said Mazal Tov. The second Dayan said Mazal Tov. The third Dayan looked at her and said, "What does it feel to know that? What does it feel like to know that for 2,000 years people have been persecuting your ancestors?" Right? A Ger, right, feels alienated, right? But that just, right, that just highlights the problem. Right? A Ger says, "You're right. I have a future with you. I don't have a past with you." Right? If you look, and the Tsaritz says the exact opposite. Yes, I come from this community, but what? For what? Right? For us. Right, where am I going? Look back at the verses now for just a moment. Right, look in verse 4. Go Amar Hashem l'Tsaritzim asher yishmu v'chaptotai, that the Tsaritz buys into it. Verse 5, v'natat l'v'vitiv v'chodama yad v'Hashem tov mibanim v'nos, shem olam eten lo, I will give them eternal, right, they have a future combined with us, right, a shared future with us. And the same thing about the Ger. The Ger says, I have no past. He says, I can't recreate your past. But I can't change. I can't let you say, right? That's a halachic issue. When you say Elohei Avraham, Elohei Yitzchak, Elohei Yaakov, right? Right when the Ger comes to read the Mikra Bikurim, there's a question: how can he say the God of my forefathers? Right? It's a debate in the halacha. But the prophet promises him, 2,500 years ago, right? You have something that will be the equivalent, the moral equivalent of a shared past. Today in Medinat Yisrael. Not 300,000 Russians, right? The overwhelming majority of the Jewish people in Israel either feel they have no shared past with the Jewish world, Jewish people, or no shared future with them. That's the challenge. And yet the law says, the law incredibly, remarkably, and perhaps correctly, gives the Orthodox rabbinate, or the ultra-Orthodox rabbinate, rabbinical courts, the right to help these people, the opportunity to present for these people a shared past or a shared future. You have people who aren't halachically Jewish. You have people who, I should have said last night, right? People I mentioned to someone this morning. Maybe I wasn't contentious enough last night. When people say, right, that, and again, with a lot of respect to my colleagues who were sitting on the panel last night, it's not fair to talk about them with them not here. But I feel like the Tel Aviv street that I meet every single day says, I don't care about the Rabbanut. That's not relevant to me. Right? I spoke to a group, a think tank in Tel Aviv, a week and a half ago. Of 21 people in the room, 20 said they have no intention of getting married through the Rabbanut. They're all Jewish. They're all can get married. They have no intention of it at all. They said, what do I need that for? Why should I give credit to that institution? That's a challenge. Now, it's a particular challenge when it comes to personal status issues. And here's where I'm coming to the new halachot issue. See, when people come into rabbinical courts to and have their personal status challenged in all sorts of ways, rabbinical courts have two ways to address it. They can either say, hey, this sense of disenfranchisement, this alienation, this opportunity is the great moment where we can bring people back in, where we can give people an opportunity, particularly when it comes to... Thank you. I appreciate your help. Where we can give people the opportunity to connect to the future of the Jewish people. And the way we do that is in a very, very symbolic way. By enabling them to get married, Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. It's really symbolic. Between you and me, do we really care if someone gets married or they're just living together? They get married in a private ceremony? They get married in Cyprus? Right? I always say this to people in the establishment. I say, why is it so important to you to make someone feel, right, as you all know, right, you know from the stories, but women, secular women, are forced to go to the mikvah for the most part before they get married. I say, are we going to throw this person's entire relationship to Judaism in question to force a woman to go to the mikvah before she gets married if you know she's not going to go to the mikvah, right, down the road for the duration? Again, I'm not saying I'm opposed or for. I'm just saying that that's a challenge. There are rabbis who are sensitive to this. They see the opportunities in front of them. And I want to share some of the stories that have come to us. Now, some of these stories are very case sensitive. And again, I call these the new halachot because these are the rabbis that are addressing these issues are addressing them from a Kol Yisrael perspective. They understand what's at stake. They understand that the person or the couple standing in front of them, if they come to get married, have a chance of have a strong future. And if they don't, then they don't. Last night I talked about three cases, right? I brought three psak dins of people whose conversions were annulled, even though, right, as I mentioned last night, a conversion annulment has legally been more or less stopped. What I didn't mention is that at least two of the couples who had their conversions annulled left Israel. Right? It's not just that they were told they're not part of the Jewish people. They're not part of the Jewish, right? They're not part of the halachic community. They left Israel. They gave up. They're not part of this anymore. So I say that this is case sensitive because some of the material I'm going to discuss right now is exceptionally sensitive, and I apologize from the beginning if I offend anybody in the room. So I'm going to run through very quickly a couple of halachic things that have come my way that are very, very interesting, and I think are kind of opening new ground in halacha, particularly because of this sense of not wanting people to feel alienated. First case is a story that came to my attention. It's actually still in process, but it's a case that we've been working on for 2 years. A fellow in Haifa, I'll call him Avraham Cohen for now, fell in love with an immigrant from the Soviet Union. He had no idea that she wasn't halachically Jewish, and subsequently, in the context of their romance, she converted, and then they walked into the Rabbanut. And she had some questions. There were some questions whether she was originally Jewish or not, but anyway, they walked into the Rabbanut, and as you're all aware, there's a debate, midirabbanan, midoraita, the Machloket Rambam and the Ravad, whether a Kohen, there's no debate whether a Kohen can marry a convert. Clearly a Kohen cannot marry a convert. The question is, what's the legal basis of that? But our friend Avraham was very devastated. He had been in love with this woman for 5 or 6 years, and he really wanted to explore all avenues before giving up and going to Cyprus. And that's kind of the typical call we get at our office. And when he called our office, he said, I know a Kohen cannot marry a Giyoret. He said, I'm aware of that halacha. He said, but in the last year, there's been a development. And again, I say, this is very, very sensitive. And again, if I offend anybody there, please forgive me. I want to crystallize the issue, so I'm using a practical case. He said, unfortunately, in the last year, I was diagnosed with cancer, and I went through very heavy doses of chemo. And in that context, I was rendered medically sterile. Right? I cannot bring children into the world. Now, when he called us the first time, he said, I want to know. I understand that if someone's a balmom, right, then maybe they don't qualify as a Kohen. Right? Just to give the broader thing, no one can get up and say, right, I'm not a Kohen. You're not allowed to do that. But he said, maybe I'm a balmom. Which is a question. Could a balmum marry a yard? But there's a separate question involved here, which is one that we decided to explore. Balmum is someone who has a physical defect. The secondary question that we broached with our friend Avraham, who, by the way, right, I should just make it very clear, he's not Orthodox, and he has no intention of being Orthodox, right, notwithstanding the fact that his fiance or his girlfriend is a Giyoret, right, but he finds himself traditional, right in the center of the Tel Aviv stream. Haifa Street, in this case. We said that maybe we should explore a different avenue. One of the reasons, if one looks closely at the halacha, that a Kohen cannot marry a Giyoret, relates to who is considered part of, in general, the Kahal. Right? The normative, that's what I called about, the internal community. Who hovers around the periphery and who hovers on the inside. And many of you are aware, there's a biblical verse in Dvarim that talks about the fact that someone who is a saris, right, and again I use this, right, associated with the verse that we talked about before, so someone who is, right, who was castrated, or someone who cannot bring, theoretically, someone who can't bring children into the world, a male, right, is not allowed to marry, right, at least halachically, on simple. Now, he's not allowed to marry a Jewess, a woman who was born Jewish. Right? That's a pasuk in the Torah. Lo yavo, right? Saris, right? B'kal Hashem, right? It could be that a saris is not considered part of the kahal. Right? Someone who is legally sterile, right? Who absolutely cannot bring men and children into the world, might actually not be considered part of the kahal. And therefore, even if he is a Kohen, in principle, or it's by stock, theoretically, the prohibition for him to marry a a convert might be eliminated. And we offered Avram to explore this possibility. Avram said, I'll do anything to get married to my fiance. And again, he didn't have to do very much. And this is a question that was brought. It was actually not brought by us. It was brought by someone else before to someone who, Professor Sperber, a friend of Professor Sperber, who I actually give you credit for, connecting me with originally, to someone who was then serving on the Beit HaDin HaGadol in the Supreme Rabbinical Court, who provided the following groundbreaking, to a large extent, analysis of the situation. He has a long discussion there. And again, if you don't follow the details, it's okay, because the next passage you will follow, I assure you. But he has a groundbreaking discussion, again, based on the principle that you can see he's doing his best, and you'll see it explicitly in just a moment. He's doing his best to try to say, I want to understand what's at stake here. If I don't come up with some way to allow Mr. Avram Cohen to marry this woman, then not only are we sending them to Cyprus, we're essentially divorcing them from the one moment where they can have a symbolic connection to normative halachic Judaism. And thus, we're going to do our best. Now, his argument basically explores whether someone who went through a dose of chemotherapy that would render him sterile qualifies as saris. That's a more technical argument. I don't want to go into that. And I'm going to read this in Hebrew because the Hebrew is so much more powerful than my pathetic English translation. So that's on the second page. It looks like this, on the third page. And I'm just going to read you his summary. He writes as follows. This is Rav Shlomo Duchovsky. Yesh makom lahatir la'shoel lisa et ha'giyoret ha'meduberet. There is basis, based on the arguments that he provided before, to allow this Kohen to marry the specific Giyoret. Al yisod serufam shel ha'markivim ha'marim le'el, based on the conditions that we mentioned above. Again, you have the English translation here on the first page if you wanted it. And here's the real critical part for me. Because this is the statement you generally hear from the sociologist of halacha, not the halachist himself. Says the halachist, again, given this context, and again, this is someone who's a dayan on the Beit HaDin HaGadol, right? He's a rabbinical court judge on the Supreme Rabbinical Court in Israel. He subsequently retired. But he says as follows, Yadati gam yadati. I am fully aware. Ki ilu haita she'ilat ha-shoel hafucha. Had the questioner's question been opposite, right? Remember, just the details. In this case, the Kohen came and said, I want to, right, I'm sterile, right, I want to be, right, I want you to tag me, right, if you understood the details, I want you to tag me as a saris, so that I'm no longer part of the kahal, so I can marry a giyoret, right, a woman who converted. So he says, had the question been the opposite, meaning, hayam mevakesh heter lavo b'kahal benot Yisrael, had this Kohen, who underwent chemotherapy and was rendered, right, sterile, come and said, may I marry a regular Jewess, which a saris cannot. But you understand the flip side? Right now he's saying, I want to be tagged as a saris so I can marry the giyoret. But that means that the next time, if we're going to tag everybody who went through chemotherapy and was rendered sterile as a saris, that means they can't marry a regular Jewess, not a giyoret, right? They can't marry a, because there's a pasuk in the Torah. Someone like that is not in the kahal. Says Rav Dichovsky, had he come and said, "Lavo b'kal b'nei Yisrael," he said, "But Israel, azai hayinu osim et kol ha'ma'amatzim, we would have made every effort limso petach shel heter lavo b'kahal, to find some sort of opportunity to allow him to marry her as well. We're going to allow it and the opposite. We're going to tag him as saris so he can marry this woman, and we're going to tag the next guy not as saris so he can marry a regular Jewess." That's his argument. That is a staggering argument. In order to, right, the enabling factor for this couple standing in front of me right now, knowing what's at stake, which is their future connection to the Jewish people, for this couple, so I'm going to say the exact opposite. Right? Yesh li hishtadel, I can make every effort in so petach heter, gam bekivun hazeh. And then for those of you who are familiar with the rabbinic Hebrew, al kein ne'amar b'mishnah, hafochba v'hafochba dekulaba. Right? Turn it over and turn it over, you can find anything in it. So he's saying, I'm willing to basically issue piskei halacha that are fundamentally contradictory, start to finish. And he says, because I'm, right, essentially the subtext, or the way I read the subtext is, look what's at stake here. Right? What are our alternatives? He continues, Nitan lahashvot davar zeh lishnei shvilin. Right, there's a famous Talmudic passage that relates to the issues of purity and impurity. Imagine the following situation. You have a Kohen. He's not allowed to become impure in rabbinic times, right? In early rabbinic times. Now, we know there's something impure. There's two roads, the high road and the low road, and we know there's something impure on one of them, right? And we have two Kohanim standing here, right? Or even one Kohen, right? Let's say two Kohanim, right? And one walks on one road the first way, right? And 15 minutes later, another one walks on the other way. Now, we know that one of the Kohanim, right? Or that with one Kohen even. When he walks on the first road, we're able to say it's on the second road. When he walks on the second road, we're able to say it's on the first road. It's on one of the roads. The answer is halakha has, I don't want to even call it flexibility. Built into halakha is the opportunity for halakha not to be a stumbling block before people. But the opposite. It's to ennoble people. Right? Halakha is a way, is a system of law that enables people to do things within, in my mind, you know, some sort of divine context. And then he says the ultimate line. Again, this is not, I want you to remember, because it's so important. This is not the sociologist talking, right? We can sit in the university all day and, right, and describe the sociology. This is the posek talking. Contradictory declarations. It's conceivable to say, given what's at stake, that's the critical point for me. Given what's at stake, sheha emet hailchatit eina chayevet liyot zehe laemet ha'uvdatit. That is not something you hear every day from a posek, right? From any posek. That's a psak in my mind that can only come out of a certain historical context, right? Standing on the precipice of redemption, at least in my mind, right? Just to clarify what he said, factual reality does not necessarily have to correspond to the halachic reality. The kol shelefi kalei halacha efshar lifsok leheter, as long as within the halachic principles we can find a way out for them, ein tzorech leitchashev bastira ha'alula lehivatzir, we do not have to consider the contradiction that will emerge from such a psak. Now I'll just tell you the end, the caveat to this, right? We took this psak halacha, we took it to another rabbinical court judge, in the Haifa Rabbinical Court, Ephraim Cohen, who's, by the way, very, very sympathetic to these kinds of situations. And Ephraim Cohen, I don't know, do you know him? So he wrote a very long tshuva, basically supporting this, but saying, I want one more rabbinical court judge to support us. And without going into the details, if you look on the next page, you'll see a pen from Rav Amar. And I tell this story because I don't want you to think that I'm here to glorify our work. You can see here's a long letter from Rav Amar, where Rav Amar, the chief rabbi, refuses to accept this principle. And there's a letter on the bottom that they also went to Rav Avadya Yosef, and he refused it. He refused. And they went to Rav Shlush, and he refused. And they went to Rav Mazuz, and he refused. And in the end, Ephraim did not marry in the rabbinate his fiance. I say this story continues because there's an added dimension that just came up in the last couple of weeks. This is, again, I say that there's, right, this is an enabling. Rav Duchovsky's psak is a psak that enables it. It allows people to feel enfranchised when otherwise they would feel completely disenfranchised. Does halakha simply become a game? Right? Is it, right, I don't know if Blue Greenberg was the first one to say it. Is this where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way? Or do I like to say it in Hebrew? Im tirtzu enzo halakha? Right? But I don't know if that's what's at stake here. I think there's something else at stake here. I think built into the halachic process, at least for these kinds of people, is something fundamentally, right? So this is like cool. This is a new halacha emerging, but this is something that's addressing the modern changes. Does Rav Duchovsky say explicitly? He doesn't say explicitly, look, right? I understand what's at stake in terms of the social context of Medina Yisrael. He doesn't say that. But I'm relatively certain that's the subtext. A very similar thing, which is a totally new area, I'd like to share with you from the next page. I'm very proud that the first time we got this query, it was actually a hafnaya, a referral, thank you, from the Reform Movement in Israel. And I am not embarrassed about the fact that I have a good working relationship, a positive working relationship with the leadership of the Reform Conservative Movements in Israel and here also, or in the U.S. primarily. and a young couple, his name, again, I'm going to deal with the Cohen issues first, Udi Cohen, fell in love with an immigrant from the former Soviet Union, not a Gioret. And Natasha, this will be my next talk in a few minutes, but she went into the Rabbanut. They went into the Rabbanut together. Udi and Natasha went in, and they said Udi's parents were married in Israel, so he didn't have to prove he was Jewish. Natasha, like many immigrants, like all immigrants, had to prove she was Jewish. They sent her in Rehovot upstairs to the rabbinical court. In the rabbinical court, they looked at her papers. They interviewed her mom, who was an Olah. They did some investigation, whatever they did. And a month and a half later, they got back a letter that said that she was able. I should have brought the letter. I apologize for not photocopying the text. But they got a letter saying Natasha's mother is Jewish. We certified the rabbinical court. We certified Natasha's mother is Jewish, and she can get married to anybody. And then it added two words: Lebar Mikohen, right? Which literally translates, if you know the Aramaic little, is excluding a Kohen. Now, they had no idea because they said she was Jewish, and after all, didn't we all grow up thinking that if your mother's Jewish, you're Jewish, right? That's what they told us, right? So, Lebar Mikohen. So, if they thought it was a mistake, and that it should say Imrav Mechahen, right? So, they went downstairs, they thought it was just a switch in the letters, and they went downstairs to the Rabbanut, Udi Kohen, Natasha, and they said, we're here, you told us to get the letter proving we're Jewish, great, here we are, and they handed it into the Rabbanut. And the Rabbanut said, if that's you, you can't get married. They said, what do you mean we can't get married? My mother's Jewish, right? She said, what do you mean? And they said, well, you see here, it says you can't get Jewish. That's all it said. And the Lev Brera, without any choice, they called the Reform Movement. They said they were getting married, 5 weeks later. And they called the Reform Movement. They said, which is according outside of the law. And again, it's going to dismiss, right, an entire body politic, right? It's going to dismiss these people. Now, what's the issue at stake? The issue at stake is a very fascinating issue. Just one quick step back to the Talmud and the Gemara Masechet Yevamot. It's true that we grew up, right, thinking, we were told, correctly so, that if someone's mother is Jewish, then they are halachically Jewish. The question is, there's an elusive phrase in the Talmud, which, for the most part, again, not in Talmudic times, of course, but in the medieval period was a very inoperative phrase. Right? The Talmud says, if your mother is Jewish, then you're kasher liYisrael. The phrase kasher liYisrael can have two meanings. Again, I'm simplifying a little. Right, correct. Kasher liYisrael can have a limited meaning or an expansive meaning. A limited meaning, right, an expansive meaning would mean anybody whose mother is Jewish can marry a Jew. Right? That's the way we do it. What's the limited meaning? The limited meaning is kasher liYisrael, but not a Kohen. What do you need to marry a Kohen? Two parents being Jewish. Now, you'll think, you've never heard such a thing before. Right, but in fact, this is a debate in the Rishonim between the Rosh and the Rambam. Right, this is a debate, right? Which again, I don't know in Talmudic times, but certainly in medieval times, it was a highly irrelevant debate. What do I mean it was a highly irrelevant debate? I want you to think about what are the chances that a woman whose mother was Jewish and whose father wasn't Jewish would come to marry a Kohen in traditional Jewish society, right? Take traditional European Jewish society. The Sephardi community, there was no intermarriage. In the Ashkenazi community, there was virtually no intermarriage, right? Think about what the set of circumstances would have to happen in the medieval, I'm not going to call it shtetl, but the medieval Jewish society, because I'm not talking about the shtetl, right? I'm talking about all the Jewish communities. Think what would have to happen, right? What are the chances, right? Certainly in the shtetl, if someone intermarried, right, if a woman, a Jewish woman, married a non-Jewish man, there was no chance the kids would come back to the community to get married. And what were the chances the kids would get married to a Kohen? Right? Literally inconceivable, right? In all of halachic literature, for 800 years, there's something like 6 cases like this in all of the tshuvot that we've been able to find. Right? In 800 years of tshuvot literature, right? You have the case? Woman, child of an intermarriage, right? Right, and most of those cases are cases, and again, forgive me, because I talk about this material as if I talk about it way too crassly, and I'm aware of that, and please, I apologize. But most of those cases are cases of rape. Right, a woman shows up to a community. She moves to the community with her young daughter. Right, the children grow up. They shadchan her off, right, they don't know who the father is. By chance, they shadchan her off to a Kohen. And then it turns out she was raped, and that's where the kid came from. Right? She was raped by the local whatever. Right, so the father's not Jewish. And then they have to start addressing the question. That's where it is in halakhic literature. Statistically, this exact situation, for the reasons I described before, will happen how many times this year in Israel? At least 150. You know why? Because for the first time in the history of the Jewish people, by the way, yashar koach to you, you should take credit for this. Right? You should take credit for this, right? Because, right, we're the people, right, who brought out immigrants from the former Soviet Union. I'm not talking about the ones who aren't halachically Jewish. I'm talking about the 700,000 plus who are halachically Jewish and who can prove they're halachically Jewish. Right? Of those, between 70 and 80% are children of intermarriages. Right? I'm just going to run you through the statistics quickly, right? 50% of them are women. Right? That means, right? If between 4 and 7% of the population is Kohanim, then there you have it, 150, between 100 and 150, depending on what number you choose. You understand? We have an enormous population of young people who are children of young women who are children of intermarriages who are coming to Kohanim, who are coming to marry Kohanim in the Rabbanut. Now, 9 times out of 10, if they walk into the Rabbanut says, yes, there's a machloket, but you know what it says in the Shulchan Aruch? I'll tell you what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. It says, lachatchila, we don't know. It doesn't say lachatchila. It says, we don't allow Kohanim to marry children of intermarriages. Chad mashmai. Right? Absolutely straightforward. But remember, what's at stake? What's at stake is a meta-halachic issue. To not allow these people to get married is to basically provide them, or to put up a barrier in front of the one opportunity. It's symbolic. I agree it's symbolic. For them to be part and parcel of the, you know, of the religious Jewish dimensions of Medinat Israel. And thus the question becomes, what can we do about it? And this is a question we've pushed, and we've pushed it at this point, and I'm very proud of this. We've pushed it 10 times in the rabbinical court. So the first time we were in Rehovot, and we took Udi and Natasha back upstairs to the rabbinical court, and we argued the case in front of them, and our argument was basically based on one text. It was a text that said, right, it's a text written by the Beit Shmuel, right, it's a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, who said, yes, of course, lechatchila, you shouldn't allow a Kohen to marry the child of an intermarriage, right, where the father's not Jewish. By the way, I assume you're aware, right? In North America, this also happens a lot, right? I just don't think people ask the question so much, right? I assume it happens as well. But here, you have a legal entity. In other words, the rabbis aren't allowing them to get married, right? They have the right to do that. So we went to the rabbinical court. The Beit Shmuel, 18th century, says this very simply. He says, lechatchila, it's true, but b'di'eved, we're not going to impose this halacha. Now, what does b'di'eved mean in the medieval context or in the early modern context? What does it mean? Right. So b'di'eved is after the fact. Meaning what happened? This woman, you remember I told you this woman who got raped and then she went? So the child comes to get married. They got married. And then someone says, oh, by the way, did you know the father wasn't Jewish? So the father shows up and says, that's my child. So we don't force them to get, right, in the time of Jewish autonomy, we don't force them to get divorced. What does b'di'eved mean today? What does it mean in the modern Israeli context? That's a question we pushed the Rehovot rabbinical court on, and we failed. And then we appealed to the chief rabbi, in this case Rabbi Amar, and in his rabbinical court, he was very willing to explore the fact that b'di'eved today can mean a lot more than just they got married and then we found out about it afterwards. And again, he cites earlier literature. I brought it here from a p'sak din from Rav Ben Shimon in Tel Aviv, but he quotes here. I'll just quote one part of it. He quotes a tshuva of the Dvar Yehoshua, Rav Yehoshua Ehrenberg, where this is on the page that has Medinat Yisrael on top and the Beit Din in Tel Aviv on the bottom. Right. In the middle of the page, he says, Kol zeh katavti rak laharot tzadei ha'eter b'shat tzorech gadol. When there's a tremendous need, then we have the capacity to apply this unique heter. Based on your question, it seems to me sheyesh tzorech lahatir. Kevan, listen quietly. This is very right. You can listen carefully, and you'll chuckle a little. Kevan shekvar hitkashra im kohen be'avotot ahava. Right? Do you know what that means? They're right. How did I translate it? They are tied in. Right? You understand what that means, right? That's the rabbinic way of saying they're living together. Right, the couple's living together already. They're avotot ahava. Right. By the way, this is one of the few times in halachic literature that love plays an important role. Right. Echomrim ken yerbum, ken v'hit arsaimo. You ever see this in a halachic tshuva before? What is hit arsaimo? Right. Catholic engagement. Right. No, that's engagement. That's not. There was no halachic engagement here. Right. They announce to the world they're engaged. That has halachic significance. Right. He says, yesh bazeh mishum aguna. Right? It's already aguna not to allow them to do it. And then he says, "Vachanami kevan shenitkashra b'shogeg." It was an accident. They didn't know this was the halacha. Right? Shelo yada adin yesh lahakel aleha shema lo timtza adam acher sheisaina. Right? And he says, now I want to tell you, when we brought this, the first time we brought this to the Beit Adin Gadol in an appeal, we got a letter from not the chief rabbi, but we went to the, and we said we, right, because the way it works is you got to, sometimes we tell the local rabbinical courts, there's 12 of them, just tell us no so that we can appeal to the Beit Adin Gadol. I'll show you an example of that in a minute. But this is a great example, right? So we went, they told us no, we appealed to the, right, we went and opened the file. We, at this point, go and open the file for the family because we don't want the family to feel more alienated. And I actually didn't go myself. We sent one of the lawyers who works for us. And the mazkir, the clerk of the Beit Din, said, "Why are you trying to undermine the kahuna in Medinat Yisrael?" That's what he said. That was his response. And we said, look, we feel like if there's a way, a halachic way of exploring this, then it ought to be explored till the end. Because this isn't halacha operating in a vacuum anymore, or in a shtetl anymore. It's not just real people that are standing in front of us, which is what it was for the last 2,000 years. It's more than just that. It's precedence, and it's halacha ledorot. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that, and again, I take a lot of pride in this, that the first time we had to appeal from Rehovot to the Supreme Rabbinical Court, and the second time we had to appeal from Ashdod to the Supreme Rabbinical Court, and the third time we were in Tel Aviv at Rabbi Ben Shimon. Rabbi Ben Shimon is a very, very senior rabbinical court judge. He certainly doesn't see everything our way. But he looked at me, called me into his room afterwards, and he said, "Shaul, whenever this case comes up, you send them to me. I will fix it for the whole country. Because I'm willing, I understand what's at stake. I'm willing to apply this b'dieved. I see that this is all b'dieved." B'dieved means, can you imagine what we do? We take couples, and we say, "Show us you have a joint bank account. Prove to the rabbinical court," right? It's going to sound ridiculous. "Prove to the rabbinical court that you're pregnant." And that's what we tell them. We tell them, "You're pregnant? Good! That means you can get married." Right? We don't want to tell. No, it's good, right? No, I'm not telling people to go get pregnant. I'm just, right? You understand? Before they get married, right? No, but again, I say this is meeting people where they are. Right? And nowadays, and I'm proud of this, in Rehovot, they already say, "We know you're going to take it to the Supreme Rabbinical Court, so fine, we'll just be ma'asheret here already." And that's what happens. That happens nowadays. That's a big accomplishment. Again, you understand what I mean by halacha ledorot? We've created a precedent because of the meta issue that's at stake here. The meta issue that's at stake here is an entire population of people who either we have the opportunity to connect or we have the opportunity to alienate and disenfranchise. Just like Isaiah, just like 2,500 years ago. I want to show you one more. I want to show you two more examples. Okay. What should I do here? Okay. How about I do them really? No, I won't have time to do both. Okay, I'll do them very quickly. Okay. A few years ago, I was on TV in one of the morning shows with a couple who I performed their wedding. Nice young couple, very typical Israeli story. No problems, right? It's a very typical Israeli story. They went to India after the army on the lark, right, together as a couple. They went, they got married in some, I don't know what, right? They got an official, Indian marriage certificate. They came back, "Mom, Dad, we're married." And the parents said, "No, you're not." And they said, "Yes, we are." They said, "You're absolutely not married. Not in my house. You're going to get married through the Rabbanut." They said, "Okay." And they went to the Rabbanut, and the Rabbanut said, "We can't get you married because you're already married." Right? Which was, a surprise answer. They were prepared for that. They came back to their parents. The parents called us, and we said, no, you just have to get a special thing, a special dispensation that says even though you were married civilly, you weren't married halachically. Fine. There was a whole debate. In the end, we got it for them. They got married. They were connected to some TV thing. The TV came. They filmed me in my backyard, right? As you can imagine, right? I've said this to a number of people. Our house is a very strange house, right? We often wonder what's happening with our kids. The kids can come home at 2 o'clock in the afternoon from school, and there's a wedding of a 9-month pregnant bride, in our backyard. And we said to my son Moshe, he said, I said to him one day, like, "Why don't you like bring friends over?" He said, "Like, you think I should bring friends over when this is going on in the backyard?" And I think I'm the only one. Parent with a 10-year-old kid who can tell you 9 different reasons why a Kohen can't get married to somebody. Anyway, so we were on television with them, which of course also it lends itself to all sorts of things, right? I don't always go on TV, but this case, it was sweet, it was nice, it was a nice story. 75 Saftot called me within 15 minutes. "Can you marry our children also?" Right? One woman called the office and said, "I've been waiting 14 years to speak to you. I usually don't pick up the phone. In fact, I rarely pick up the phone because we're trying to communicate, you know, Yisraeliut, and my accent obviously gives it away. And so the other people, but whatever, she insists on speaking to me, and we're not going to say no. What's your story? She grew up in what we now know as Chechnya, and in a small town called Nilchik, and she was getting old in 1977 or so. She was already 16 or 17, and she wasn't married. It was under Islamic, you know, culture at least. And her father married her off to some cousin. He was abusive, and after a couple of months, she left him and came back to her father's house, and she studied, and she was on her way to a doctorate in economics. And in the early 90s, some businessmen from Israel came in through this small town, and one of them met her, and they fell in love, and they went to the local civil authority, they got married, and she came to Israel, all Jewish. She comes from a very traditional background. I wouldn't call it orthodox in the normative North American sense, but very traditional background. And this young woman said, you know, it was always my dream to get married to the Moshe of Israel and the Rabbanut. In other words, I want an official. So they went into the Rabbanut. And the Rabbanut said, it says on your document that you're still married to the first guy, right? What do you have? Can you show us the get? She said, I never got a get from the first guy. I walked away. He was abusive. So, and to the Rabbanut's credit, I give them a lot of credit for this. This is something that doesn't happen less today, but it happened then because then there were representatives, etc. They sent someone into Nilchek. They found the guy. They got him to write a get. All good, right? Great. They brought the get back to Haifa. Then Rav Zalman Nechemya was the Avedin. And they issue the get. Great. So she says, now I can get married, right? So she gets the get. And what does the get say on it? Right? Not the get, but the document she gets. It says you can marry anybody except for a Kohen and except for your present husband. Why can't you marry your present husband? Because Judaism has an Orthodox Judaism, Halachic Judaism, views, as long as she was married the first time, and essentially if she was married to someone else, while still married to the first guy, she was having an adulterous relationship, and Judaism, Orthodox Judaism, Halachic Judaism, doesn't allow for her to continue a relationship with someone she was having adultery with. Now, there's a solution to this problem, right? There's actually a broad solution to this problem that has been implemented across the board. The point is, in Israel, it's a much broader problem. Right. It's not exactly annulling the first marriage, but it's questioning the status of the first marriage at all. The problem was, this is where the rabbinical court fell short. Because they didn't say, they said, we can't help you. Instead of saying, let us look into this. Right, let's go, because so what? So the judges then said, and unlike Rav Amar, the judges then said, so what? So you won't get married. What's the big deal? Go to Cyprus. That's the typical answer. I'm going to do this very, very quickly. But essentially she came to us, right? Totally by chance, right? Because she happened to see me on TV. Right? And she said, can you help me? She had no idea what the solution was. And we said, okay, we'll help you. We'll try to look into the original marriage. We sent someone to interview her up in her town. Now she's the president of a bank. By the way, she's married to this guy. No one knows. No one knows that she's not married. She still feels, it's not even guilt. It's not guilt that she feels. I don't want to write, this isn't like the Hungarian North American context. She doesn't come from that. She says, this is will. I want to be fully part of the Jewish people. And that means for me getting married to Moshe Yisrael. Right? I'll take questions in just another minute. Anyway, we sent someone into Nilchik, which then was really during the war, someone who we got the permission of the rabbinical court so they would trust us. And he interviewed. Everybody was at the wedding, and really nothing happened at the wedding. You know, it's nothing halachic, of halachic significance, right? In their community, they didn't give a ring. The man picked up the woman and carried her over the threshold, things like that. Right? Anyway, we went back, we brought the representative back to the rabbinical court with his videos. He showed everybody, and the rabbinical court simply wouldn't make a decision. For months, they wouldn't make a decision. Finally, they said, it's outside of our jurisdiction because the original get was given in Haifa, and we're in Jerusalem, and we can't deal with it. So we sent it to Haifa, and they said, we didn't hear the aid. We didn't hear your witnesses, so we can't. And finally, we just told them, forget it. Tell us she can't get married. We brought it to the Beit HaDin HaGadol. This was actually a watershed moment for me. Because our appointment, but this all took 9 or 10 months, but our appointment was at 9 o'clock in the morning. 9 o'clock in the morning, I'm there with the woman, her husband. We're waiting outside the rabbinical court, and other people start going into to the chief rabbi, in, out. At 11 o'clock, I said, what's going on? And to the clerk, and the clerk says, we're waiting for the other side. And I looked at him, and I said, you're the other side! Right? You're the one who's preventing this woman. There is no other side. There's no, right? It's them against the halakha. Or it's the halakha in service of them or stopping them. Anyway, the psak din you have in front of you, which I don't have time to read right now, but the psak din in front of you is the psak din that Rav Amar, again, to his credit, who recognizes, and again, I'll be very honest, a close reading of this text, which is a little difficult to decipher in Hebrew, and you'll forgive me, a close reading of this text shows that he's willing to twist the facts, literally twist the facts, in order to, excuse me for a second, I'm sorry, I thought I turned that off, but he's willing to twist the facts, essentially, in an effort to solve this woman's problem, not just this woman's problem. But basically, he says, the end of the tshuva, basically, when this happens, come to me, because I understand what's at stake here. I understand that we simply cannot allow hundreds, if not thousands of people who got married in ceremonies that were very questionable when it comes to halachic validity, we can't simply allow them to not be able to get married, right? Hold them up. We can't allow that anymore. That's what I call, again, the halacha, the new halachot. The new halachot is they're addressing a new reality. So let me just summarize, and then I'll take questions for a couple of minutes. The argument I'm trying to put forward in front of you today is probably the most interesting argument of modernity, right? Of Orthodox or halachic Judaism confronting modernity. It's what happens when we have to apply halacha to not just a modern situation, but a body politic, a group of people who don't adopt the halachic system. It doesn't interest them, and yet right now, at least according to the legal constitution of Israel, it affects them every day. And what I'm trying to show you is that there's good news to report. There's also bad news to report, right? I have much more bad news to report that I'm not sharing with you. But there are different streams. Right? There are people who are saying we need to explore, right, the areas, the new areas of halacha, not unlike what Rav Rimon spoke about last night. We need to start applying areas of halacha that were underdeveloped or not developed at all now, given the current circumstances, given the fact that right now the law is forcing us to impose our will, the halachic will, upon others. And that manifests itself particularly in the area of marriage, which I say is symbolic but important. Symbols also have importance. There's another stream that says, no. We maintain, right, what they would argue is halachic integrity. What I'm arguing is this is halachic integrity. But they would argue that's halachic integrity, the purity, as the phrase Eliot used. Like the purity of halacha as appears in the Shulchan Aruch, independent of the present circumstances. It's obvious that in my point of view, and from the people we help, and the hundreds of people we help, it's important to try to explore that first model. I feel like that's, as I said at the beginning, Yashan Vegam Chadash. It's an old problem. Right? People feeling on the periphery, who we have the opportunity to bring to the center. Isaiah spoke about it when they were standing on the precipice of their redemptive moment. I believe we're standing also in experimental mode, but also on the precipice of a redemptive moment. And as such, I think we have to do our best to move those who consider themselves on the periphery, or to some extent who we're forcing onto the periphery, back to the center. Thank you very much. Let me quickly take a couple of questions. Yeah, you've been waiting very patiently. I appreciate it.
If you could just ask the questions at the microphone.
Oh, okay, please. Just 1 second, let's try to take it in order.
Rabbi Turin,
yeah. Rabbi Turin, please.
I think it's important to know that in the Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Yosef, etc., deal with the question, it's an old question, not a modern one, of the assault of the Cossacks of Khmelnytsky in 1648-49, where if you weren't killed, you certainly were raped. And what they said is that the Vod of Arba Arotzos, the rabbinical councils made up of these four different major areas in Europe, said the following: we do not want to hear about Kohanim problems. We don't want to hear about any problem. As far as we're concerned, it's wiped. And I think if you look at the problems of Soviet Jewry, that's a major precedent to be able to say, you talk about Shnei Shvilim, this is, they're telling people we know we're raped, we don't care. And a number of Rabbanim, I think, had the same attitude to Kohanim going through the Second World War II, to their wives, etc. This is a halachic precedent. It's black and white. You can look it up in the Shulchan Aruch of Eben Ezra. And it seems to me that's what we should be thinking about in terms of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. So I'll just address it for a moment. Some of you may be aware that I had a back and forth with Rabbi Bleich about one of these issues, about the Kohen and the Jewish non-Jewish father, where I argued there's something different going on here today, and I stand by that position. I'm aware of the halachic precedents for some of these areas. I think there's something fundamentally different going on, both in terms of the scope of the problem and also the implications of the psak. Because now we have, right? There are records, there's families. In other words, we're determining the status of people for the generations to come. It's not an isolated incident. It's not the Vadar Baratzot. This is Medinat Yisrael. It's a new halachic entity. Rabbi Bleicher, you're not giving credit, right? He disagreed with me. He said, no, this is all part of the halachic corpus. There's nothing new going on here at all. That's a debate that, I mean, I obviously have my strong position, but that's a debate. So your point is acceptable. I accept it. I understand it very well. I think it's important to make that I don't want to present this as if this is all radical new with no halachic precedent whatsoever. At the same time, I do think that the implications here and the meta issues that are at stake here are much broader.
Well, they were at stake then for the Jewish people.
Right, but it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that's the argument that he makes. I understand.
Okay.
That's the argument that Rabbi Black makes as well. Not using that particular example, but that's the argument. I think it's, again, I think it's fundamentally different when we have. Right. So here you have two streams, like I said. Yeah, go ahead, please.
To what extent can you attribute the problems to basic political facts in Israel and the power of the Haredi community, which has become ascendant recently, and their ability to get, if you want to say, their agenda and their people appointed? And it seems to be a demographic trend that looks like it'll continue in the future. And as opposed to, if you want to say, Dati Lumi, which seems to be on the descendant and the political basis.
Okay, it's clear that that is happening. The question is that relevant to this discussion? You'd be surprised at the judges, the rabbinical court judges, who are willing to talk to me and work with me. You'd be surprised. I'm surprised. My wife is really surprised. Because sometimes these guys might call in the middle of the night and she's like, what is going on here? In other words, it doesn't necessarily break down upon, it doesn't, not even necessarily, it doesn't break down anymore on Dati Lumi lines or Haredi lines. There's clearly an agenda that the Lithuanian yeshiva camp is trying much harder to impose its agenda, which clearly would be less sympathetic to much of the issues I described. Let me just make a general statement about that. Rabbinical court judges, what's really happened is not just the rise of political or Haredi political power. It's also the capacity to understand the power of the rabbinical courts. You know, if you look at the gedolim in the Lithuanian yeshiva community in Bnei Brak and Yerushalayim, Rav El Yashiv, who's now the recognized leader of that community, is the first leader, right? And again, it's not an appointed position, but the first gadol of that community who served in the rabbinical courts himself. I mean, he left at a certain point because he didn't like what was going on. But he's the first one to appreciate the power of the rabbinical court. So he's going to do his darndest, him and his circle are going to do his darndest, to get their people in. And because of that, that's what's really changed the difference. So again, I wouldn't base it, right? I should say, right? Rabbi Sherman, the guy who annulled the conversions, right? I'll just say it like this again. I'm not saying he's not part of the Haredi community today. But when he was appointed, he was the nominee of the Mafdal, right? The guys who annulled conversions, they wear kippot bigger than, right, knitted kippot, right? So we have certainly an unraveling of the knitted kippah. But the bottom line is that we, right, but we do have, you know, it doesn't necessarily break down along those lines because there's such a mix of peoples. Okay, can I take one more question because I feel really bad that I spoke so long? One more, please.
Unfortunately, I couldn't be here last night, and it's more a comment, maybe a bit of a question.
Yeah.
I do Mila in the city. I'm often confronted with mothers who have conservative or reform conversions or no conversions. We offer them Mila L'Shem Gerut, possibly, but my line is always, you know, I'm not a rabbi, I can't comment on your conversion, but you know, it's not accepted ever. If you would only convert Orthodox, it would be okay. And then the Israeli court comes and says that all these Orthodox conversions are no good, and I have nothing to say to them.
So, look, here, I learned a long time ago that I never make comments about the local scene, right? That's, you have to be, right? I'm enough of a fool making comments about Israel that I should, right? Look, there's a lot of complexity when it comes to these issues. I don't, right, I'm sympathetic to your position. In Israel, it comes up all the time. You have thousands of people who are intermarried who want to have brit milah for their kids. The rabbinical council's moalim division doesn't allow them to do it. There's a lot of moalim doing other things. And this issue has yet to be joined. That's the truth. Maybe it's a good thing that it has yet to be joined, but I don't have one singular response to that other than to say I'm sympathetic. Okay, like I said, I thank you very much for your time and allowing me to share some of my stories from you. And again, I hope you have a better appreciation right now of what it's like to start moving people from the periphery to the center. Thank you very much.
Thank you.